Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and we've created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. And we hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. Thank you for listening. My guest today is considered one of the world's greatest photographers. Three former US presidents own his masterpieces, along with a string of actors and sports personalities, and he oversees a multi-million dollar fine art business. He's helped raise $8 million for charity, and his energy and passion for his work mean that up to the outbreak of coronavirus, he'd not spent 18 days in the same place in the last 2 years. And this is all after spending the first 25 years of his career in the city, first as a broker and hedge fund manager before making a bold switch. Welcome today, Dave Yarrow.
It's very nice to be here.
Maybe we can start with your upbringing and I think you were born in Glasgow. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about it.
My father and my father's father and my father's father built ships. So they made military ships. It was a firm called Yarrow Shipyards on the Clyde. And they survived two world wars and then supplied a lot of ships to the Navy during the Falkland crisis in 1982. Actually, the Argentinians, I think, sunk three of our ships in 4 days. But they didn't survive the rampant trade unionism in Glasgow, which was rife at the time, and also the decline of shipbuilding in Great Britain. Shipbuilding was incredibly unprofitable. But Dad was a good salesman. I think he sold a lot of ships to, as far as I can make out, landlocked countries, which is quite a feat to be able to sell ships to landlocked countries. My upbringing was working. I was at school in Glasgow for a while and then up in near Perth in Scotland. And then I came down to England. But my early days were, if you worked in the yards, if you worked at Yana's, as it's called, they had sometimes up to 5,000 people working for them. And in a city that's 50% Protestant, 50% Catholic, almost everyone that worked at Yana's was Protestant. And that wasn't a management decision, that was a trade union decision, in the same way that people worked down the mines would be Catholic. So if you worked down the mines and you're Catholic, you supported Celtic. And if you worked in the shipyards and you're Protestant, you supported Rangers. The problem was that Celtic were a far better football team in the early 70s. And of course, in the year after I was born, they won the European Cup. And I didn't understand the sectarianism. So I just wanted to go and watch the best side. At the time, I never understood at the time why my father would park about a mile away from Celtic Park and wear a heavy coat and a sort of balaclava so he couldn't get recognized going to Celtic, because I don't think his fellow workers would have been that impressed. But I'm a proud Scot. I got there a bit now. And I went back to university in Edinburgh when I finished school down in England. So Scotland and Glasgow has been a big part of my life. And Glasgow has a very storied history.
Were you, from the early days, a kid with a camera?
I was at Marlborough College in England. And they had a small photographic society in a darkroom. And I always remember the first time that I processed my own film and saw a picture coming out through the developer. It's quite a visceral moment. And there was a slight epiphany that I felt then about 16, 17, that might be something that could be a big part of my life. This is the first thing I've ever done in my life where I feel that there's some sort of connection here. And when I went to Edinburgh University, but sport was my first love, and therefore it followed that sports photography would be something that perhaps I would not only be interested in, but not bad at, because I understood the sports that I photographed. I did quite a lot of Scottish football matches, sat behind the goal in the miserable games and poor floodlights and horizontal rain at some 9 o'clock on a Monday evening, watching Cowdenbeath play Raith Rovers in front of 230 people. It's not very glamorous, but that was a good foundation for me. And I knew then that there was something brewing. I wasn't at all good, I hasten to add. I was very, very average.
But then suddenly you find yourself, 1986, Mexican World Cup final, taking this iconic shot of Diego Maradona. Tell us about that.
The film was out recently and I was on a flight from London to Los Angeles, and I watched the film, and it's a great movie. Halfway through the film, my picture comes up on the screen, and I don't know about you, but I tend to get more emotional on planes, the altitude or whatever. Not that we're going to be going on any planes soon. And I didn't have anyone to tell that that was my picture. So I pressed the button and the stewardess came over expecting me to say, can I have a beer or a glass of wine? And I say, that's my picture on the screen. And she's going, there's a nutter in J27. Be careful of the nutter in J27. But I was actually going to be going to Buenos Aires to go and re-meet with Maradona, and very much looking forward to that possibility. But obviously those plans have been scuppered. The reason I got there was Scotland qualified, and FIFA in those days had a ruling that if your team had qualified and you were accredited under their football association, you could get a pitch pass for the final. And all the other Scottish photographers had gone home because Scotland obviously got knocked out as usual very early on. So if you're a staff photographer for the Daily Record or the Glasgow Herald, you'd have gone home. And so I was the only Scottish photographer left. So they gave me a pitch pass for the final. And I'll never forget walking out onto the stadium at about 6 in the morning. I got there 6 hours before kickoff was at midday for European TV times. And there was a heavy dew on the grass. And I remember walking from one goalpost to the other, just the only person in the stadium, thinking of the enormous privilege to be on the touchline in 6 hours' time with 120,000 people around. There's a line from Mark Twain when he says the two most important days in a person's life are the day they're born and the day they find out why. It was chaos. It was the last World Cup where when Argentina won, there must have been 25,000 Argentinian fans on the pitch. And I left in those days, even in 1986, probably about $6,000 worth of equipment, which I'd borrowed from Canon, who was one of the sponsors, in the net. Because I thought, if I try and get close to him with this big lens, I'm never going to be able to, I'm not going to be nimble enough. I just got to leave it there and get as close to him as possible with a wide angle lens. At the very moment I was right next to him, he was on a player's shoulders and he looked me right in the eye with the World Cup in his right hand. And there was a kind of, it was biblical because it was a layered narrative. There was him in the foreground, then tens of thousands of people behind, the score line in the background, and the whole Azteca Stadium. And the best bit was when I got back to the goal, my camera was still there. The camera I'd left in the netting was still there. And I've always had a kind of soft spot for Argentinians since then because they were so emotionally involved in them winning the World Cup that the idea of nicking a camera, nothing could be further from their mind.
So you're named Young Scottish Photographer of the Year and you have this passion, and then you leave Edinburgh and you decide to go into the city. So please explain.
It was an era when photography wasn't really a normal profession. Photography was something that people like train spotters did. It was not seen as a career. It was not seen as a career, certainly in my father's eyes, maybe a little bit more in my mother's eyes because she was an artist. But most of all, it wasn't seen as a career in anyone else's eyes that I was at Edinburgh University with. And this is an era when Oliver Stone's Wall Street had just come out. Everyone wanted to either be Michael Douglas or Charlie Sheen. They didn't want to be some loser photographing Cowden Beath play East Fife on a Monday evening in front of 240 people. So I'd already done an Olympics by this stage. I'd done the Olympics in 87. When I say done, I hadn't competed, I hasten to add, I'd photographed the Olympics. I was photographing Eddie the Eagle because they people thought that you put the worst photographer next to the worst ski jumper in the world and hopefully something will come together. So I worried even then that there was an imbalance between supply and demand. And also the supply just seemed to be endless, whereas the demand, if anything, was just slipping away a little bit. So it was a combination of a little bit of parental pressure, the fact that everyone had read Michael Lewis's Last Poker, they wanted to go and work on the floor at Salomon's Brothers, or they'd watched Wall Street. And it was in stark contrast to 2020, when you were at university in 1986, 87, you either went and joined an accounting, if you were doing those kind of subjects, business studies, accounting, economics, you'd either go and join an accounting firm and become a CA, or you'd join a bank. And I had two job offers, one to work for what is now Getty Images. It was a business called All Sport. They employed me in Calgary. My starting salary was $15,000 a year. The other option was to join the struggling investment bank of NatWest Bank called Canton NatWest. And that also was for $15,000 a year. I sold my soul and went into the milk round at Cantonet West.
You become a broker, or what we call now equity sales. How do you go about building a business for them?
I worked with a great bunch of people. We had a good, strong sales culture. I learned an awful lot. I think they were at the time one of the better brokers in the UK. And we learned how to be salesmen. We learned the secret. It's a bit like a marriage, I guess. You say sorry when you know you're right. You always make the person at the other end of the phone feel very special and very important. You try and entertain them. And those were the days of good expense accounts. The old line from Warren Buffett, he said, it's the only industry in the world where people come in a limousine to get advice from people that take the subway. And I look back in those days, and we're all sort of mid-20s doing these big orders. And we really didn't have a clue what we were doing. But it was long hours. And what we thought in those days, we thought we were the masters of the universe. We did think we were doing something that was quite important. Of course, we weren't at all. We were just having fun. But I do look back on those years. And if you go from quite an elitist private school to then a smart university and do a four-year course, you've had it fairly easy. And you're then thrown into a dealing room of 400 people, and it teaches you a dose of humility. But I met some great people, and that's probably been one of the best things to have come from it.
But you're being very self-deprecating, because within a matter of years, you go and leave a well-paid job on the sell side to start up a hedge fund, which then in the mid-90s was a pretty rare thing. Tell me a little bit about the motivation for that.
A lot of people say when you go and do something like that, that it's symptomatic of having self-confidence. I'm not so sure about that. I think there's an element to which it could be a manifestation of degree of insecurity, that you're actually feeling. I felt that I never wanted to be one of these people that would be at a dinner party and say, I thought about doing this, but I never got round to it. And if someone starts a conversation saying, well, I thought once about doing this, you say, shut up, you didn't. So we don't want to, it's not that interesting. If you thought about it, either you do it or you don't. And also, when you're not married and when you don't have kids, you don't have those responsibilities, that is your opportunity. That is your chance to go and try and do something. I would spend weekends store counting in retail stores if I felt there was a retailer that was Peter Lynch, the old Fidelity fund manager, always used to say that Saturday was the most important day in a fund manager's week, because it's all about Main Street, not Wall Street. And I was a slight disciple of the whole, let's focus on Main Street rather than Wall Street.
But you survived 17 years managing your own hedge fund, which, given the average life of a fund is, I think a hedge fund is circa 5 years. I mean, to what do you attribute that?
I would attribute the longevity of the fund, which still goes on, to a combination of several things. I think if you're going to panic, panic early. And we were early panickers. So I think in this current virus, we would have not captured the current situation. We would have been battened down the hatches fairly early on. If you look back and you set up a fund in 1997, what did I go through? I went through, first thing that happened was long-term capital, then the internet blowing up, 9/11, and then clearly moving on to 2006, 7, 8, a whole catalogue of things, one after the other, whether it be Bear Stearns, then the subprime, Lehman. The thing that actually was the most damaging to us was Bernie Madoff, because when I set up the fund, the only people that were going to put money with me were friends and family. Why else would anyone give me money? It was not really a fund to begin with for institutions. And so I said, if you want your money back, you can have it a week later. And I've got many, many faults as an individual, more than most, but I think I'm quite straight. And I hope I'm straight. So if you say to people, you can have your money back in 10 days' time and hold that together for 17 years, I'm as proud of that as I am the fact that we compounded 11% over the 17 years. I didn't know when that news came out on the 8th of December. I was at lunch and I didn't know who he was. I knew who some of the feeder funds, there's a feeder fund called Fairfield Greenwich that I knew of because we'd worked with them. And I was a bit wary of them, but I had no idea. And I said, oh, bloody crook, whatever. I had no idea that it was going to virtually kill our business, because of the pot of money we were running then, about 70% of it came from fund of funds that invested with him. And of course, we were an ATM. I thought we'd done okay in 2008. We should have done much better, because I was very nervous of the Scottish banks. it's quite ridiculous in 2005, a nation of 6 million people should have two of the top 10 banks in the world by market cap. But that's what we had. And a heritage of 300 years of prudence had been relegated into a culture of sales. So from prudence to sales in such a short period of time, and these massive expansions of the balance sheets. So we're short of both those banks and the Northern Rocks and whatever. But the tail of the portfolio cost us, and I think we lost something like 8% in the year, which I shouldn't have done given how nervous I was in the banking system. But it all didn't matter anyway, because the Bernie Madoff news came out and we lost 80% of our assets. That to me was the tipping point. That was the straw that broke my heart.
But even then, to suddenly sell your business and to open a photographic practice isn't obvious. What was going on in your thinking?
The first thing I'd say, Sam, is that this didn't happen overnight. I'd been working on a business model for probably 5 or 6 years. One of my problems with the old industry I had was that if you have a capacity for hard work, sometimes there isn't anything for you to do. And by overthinking and overworking, you can actually make your performance worse. So I spent about 5 years in the evenings at a time when I was single, mostly single, and had time on my hands to develop a business model. And the genesis of this goes back to photographing sharks. I spent quite a bit of time photographing great whites in False Bay off Cape Town. They don't behave now as the way that they used to do, but this is in 2011, 12, 10. And in June, you'll see these great whites predating, coming out of the water. Sharks have been photographed swimming towards a cage many times. There's no authenticity there. And I eventually got the shot after 30 hours in the water. And it was published all around the world. And I got my check back from Getty Images or whoever it was. And I think it was around about $18,000. And I thought, this is going to be the worst business model in the world because it's cost me $20,000 to take the picture. So I've got this, as far as I can see, one of the better pictures ever of a shark killing something, a seal, flying out of the water. And I'd lost $3,000. And so I thought, no. This is not a good career choice. A lawyer from Houston, Texas called me up and said, are you the kid that took the photograph of the shark? And I said, well, that might be. And he said, well, I'm an attorney and I'm called Jaws and I want one of them pictures for my wall to put the fear of God into anyone that takes me on. And he said, how much for one of them pictures of the shark? And so I didn't really know what to say then, because it wasn't the way that people looked to monetize photography. People looked to monetize photography through selling pictures to magazines, to Getty's, to the Parry matches, to the Sterns in this world. And I said, $6,000, I think he said. And he went, $6,000? So I thought I'd gone way too high. So I said, well, listen, we'll deliver it to Houston for free. And he said, no, he said, I think I'm going to have three of them, shark. That seems a good price. We'll have three. So I thought I'd gone too high, but he thought I'd gone too low. So I thought, here's an interesting dynamic that one person buying three prints can give me as much revenue as 100 newspapers printing that front page around the world. And it was when the penny dropped for me a little bit. You'll remember in Jerry Maguire, Cameron Crowe's great movie, that there's the moment where Tom Cruise has his epiphany in the middle of the night and thinks that sports agents should have less stars and give them more special attention. And he does his mission statement, puts it in everyone's cubbyhole, and then he gets fired 3 days later. And I did my kind of Jerry Maguire, how to make money from photography, and I still kept it. I wrote it in 2010, 2011. And the central premise of it was that the only way to make money in photography at a time where everyone was taking more and more pictures was to look down the fine art market. And as soon as I knew that, I started working on a business model. And there's an awful lot of cliches about success being 99% failure. It's all about how you react to the failure rather than react to the success. But we needed to secure one key art dealer in America, in Palm Beach. And he had turned me down 5 times. And if you go to Palm Beach to meet him, and he's probably the most highly regarded scholar of photography in America. And he would look at your work and he would go, thank you, but no thank you, as we've all done on many occasions to people that might be perfectly good, but he just didn't have room in his stable. And when you go back from Palm Beach to Miami, that miserable journey, and then back to London, you've got two reactions. There's two reactions to being rejected. One is you turn around and say, he's absolutely right, and I've just got to get better. That's got to be the reaction rather than saying, screw it, I'm not going to do this. So finally, after I'd taken a picture in South Sudan, I went to see him, and it was a big picture called Mankind. And he said, I'll represent you from tomorrow. And that day, I went back to Miami, and I sold the business that night. And that was it. I'd had a few espresso martinis at that stage. It was quite a cathartic moment. It was an emotional moment. And I knew straight away that I'd done the right thing. And you know what? I don't think I've traded in the stock market since then. So from trading every day for 17 years, I don't think I've traded a share in over 120 months.
So, of course, there'll be some people listening to the show who aren't familiar with your photography, and they'll hopefully afterwards go onto your website and have a look. But I think it was Robert Capa, who was the Second World War photographer and considered one of the greatest combat and adventure photographers in history, said that if your pictures aren't good enough, you're not close enough, and you have got about as close as anybody could imagine to gorillas and polar bears. And there's a sort of a greed and fear trade-off we talk about in the financial services industry. So maybe tell us a little bit how you calibrate those two emotions.
Well, firstly, I don't think I take risks with garnering original content with animals. I'm responsible. If you take risks with animals, bad things could happen to the animals as well as you. And also, I'm a father to two kids, and it would be totally irresponsible to find inappropriate ways to get around the kind of riddle of proximity. But in essence, you're right in that, and I'm a photographer rather than a wildlife photographer. It's just that I've focused on that area a little bit because I felt that it'd been a little bit neglected versus other areas of photography. And so many other areas of photography, which maybe can come on to, are a little bit out of favor at the moment, but it's perhaps serendipity that I chose to focus on the natural world, which clearly right now is the epicenter of everyone's focus, notwithstanding what's going on with the world crisis right now. If you're going to photograph a beautiful person, whether it be a man or a woman, you're never going to photograph that person from 100 feet away. If you're going to photograph Kate Moss, you're going to photograph her from 2 feet away. If you're going to photograph Jack Nicholson or DiCaprio, you're going to photograph him from 2 feet away. So why should you be photographing a polar bear from 100 feet away? Well, traditionally, obviously, the answer clearly is safety and regulation. The eyes are the windows to the soul. The irony is that I'm quite an emotional person. I'm certainly, my emotional intelligence, I think, is better than my intellectual intelligence. And fund management was all about the suppressing of emotion, whereas photography is all about the engagement of emotion.
It strikes me that there seem to be a lot of parallels with the money management business. You have to do your research, you need strong content, it's transaction focused. But of course, in the end, the owners who buy these beautiful pieces get the emotional attachment they don't get from owning Amazon shares. But that does require, at the outset, a lot of research. So tell me a little bit about how you think about your projects.
Research is the most underrated word in photography. It is absolutely pivotal to what we do. The photography, the actual execution of the picture, is fairly perfunctory in a lot of cases. It's doing the homework, it's having the contacts, it's surrounding yourself with the right people in the field and standing often on the shoulders of giants. I think we have certainly embraced the era of collaboration, and I'm a collaborator. A lot of people give me too much acclaim as almost running my own. It's David Yarra just taking pictures. I've got a good team of people, a great team of people around me. And if it wasn't for them and the research that they do, then I don't think that we would be anywhere close to where we are now. These things are always better with examples. If you take an animal like a polar bear, we could probably write 100,000 words on the four places where you're best, most likely to take a strong picture of a polar bear in the world. The pros, the cons, the return on capital employed, the logistical difficulty, the risk reward, the probability of citation. And by learning how to get it wrong, you eventually home in on where to get it right. And it's true of tigers as well as to mountain gorillas, that we are always fine-tuning on the basis of what we've learned and the mistakes that we've made to get it better the next time. And particularly because our starting premise is to have proximity and a contextual narrative. What I mean by contextual narrative is you're not just taking a picture of an animal, you're taking a picture of an animal in the habitat that defines that animal. So you're trying to be very greedy. You're trying to do two things. You're not trying to just take a portrait. You're trying to take in a portrait where the background narrative bends back and says, that is a gorilla, and that gorilla is emphatically in Rwanda. That also is true of so much of my work, and it goes back to Maradona. It wasn't just a picture of Maradona. It was a picture of Maradona in the Azteca Stadium. And the starting premise for this is research.
You mentioned earlier on Mankind, which I believe is, along with some of your photographs, has sold for nearly $100,000. And clearly that was a journey into South Sudan that was not trivial. So how did you take that project and break down into the components?
It's a funny how the evolution of that whole event, there's a lovely line from J.K. Rowling where she said that rock bottom is the solid foundation on which I built my life. And before South Sudan, I was in a fairly rock bottom place in my life. If for whatever reason your marriage doesn't work out, Christmas Day is just one day in the year. But if you're not going to spend Christmas Day with your kids because it's not your turn or whatever, that can lead to a lot of soul searching about how much you screwed up your life. That year, I thought, well, you know what? I don't really want to be around the corner on my own getting drunk or with friends. Why don't I go and try and take a big picture? So on Christmas Day, on the morning, I woke up at a United Nations camp, not far from where the civil war was really raging in South Sudan. It changed my life and it changed my position within the fine art marketplace. I went from being someone where if you didn't deal with me, there was no opportunity cost, to someone that if you didn't deal with me, there could be an opportunity cost. And opportunity cost, I think, is something that people don't talk about enough. We often pay people the opportunity cost of them leaving. And for dealers, if they don't need to deal with someone, they won't. But if there becomes a cost for them not to deal with them, then the balance of power swings enormously. And I didn't have a picture that was strong enough for that opportunity cost balance of power to swing in my favor. 2013-14 was a tough year for me. I wasn't going to spend Christmas with my kids. And it was rock bottom, I guess. My funded had performed poorly. Money was tight. Ansel Adams said, photography is not about a camera. It's about the music you've listened to, the poems you've read, the loves you've made, the loves you've lost, and the photographs of others. So he's instructing you that it's two things. It's an outer manifestation of your inner soul, but it's also about legitimately being inspired by things you've seen or being prompted by things you've seen. If you travel to the Nile and South Sudan, the Nile runs through South Sudan, the topography around the Nile is very, very flat. And if you have flat topography and then no way of getting a raised elevation, you've got a problem if you want to get depth in a picture. That's why when you were being photographed at school, your school photograph, the photographer would get you on steps and layers and benches so that you could see every face. A photographer's got a problem if he's wanting to have depth on a flat field, because if he hasn't got a position of raised elevation, he's just going to see the front line. And I looked at the work of people that have been up to the world's youngest country and a troubled country, and these extraordinary cattle camps that haven't changed for hundreds of years. And it's really as elemental, as raw, it's a kind of cradle of mankind. And they'd all made one mistake, which they hadn't found a position of elevation. So the pictures lack depth in an area that's flat. So I made the decision that I was going to take a ladder all the way up through South Sudan. which is a kind of bizarre thing to do. But that's got nothing to do with photography. Of course, it's got something to do with how you can see the end picture looking. It has got everything to do with research. My accommodation was $1 a day. I think my food was $1 a day, and my security detail was about $1,500 a day. And when I got on the ladder, we had to cross the Nile with crocodiles in it with the ladder. And I remember not being too brave about it. So I paid some of the locals to form a circle around me. So when I was wading across the Nile, if there was going to be a croc, they were going to get someone on the circle rather than me in the middle. And we got to this cattle camp, and I knew as soon, I went there twice because I had to understand the light and the composition. Composition is the heart and the engine of a photograph. So I had to know what I was going to do. I do make pictures rather than take them. And what that means is that I have a preconception, and then I try and linearly follow from that preconception through to the conception. That doesn't remove the opportunity for spontaneity, but I am going there with a preconceived notion of what I'm going to get. Lighting, time. Anyway, I knew as soon as I pressed the trigger, I got the picture. And I think sales of that picture in total have maybe been over $5 million. So it just shows that one picture, just one piece of work, it did change my life as an artist forever.
And you've had the chance to work with Cindy Crawford and Alessandro Ambrosio, and you've just done this Sunset Boulevard sort of shot. But how do you think about sources of inspiration as you go about your work?
I've got a lot of heroes. You have interviewed a lot of people in your life. I've interviewed not so many as you, interviewed for jobs. And if you say to someone at an interview, who are your inspirations, who are your heroes? And they say, I haven't really thought about that. They're kind of love 40 down to get back into the interview. I think we should all have heroes. But my heroes are mostly filmmakers. Spielberg is the director and cinematographer of our generation and probably the generation before and maybe your kids' generation. And I've almost got a little bit of a obsession in terms of his career, right back from shooting Jaws when he was 25 years old, 25 when he shot Jaws and still in the top 20 grossing films of all time. The actor he's collaborated with most over his career is Tom Hanks. And Hanks was asked, what was it that made Spielberg the cinematographer, director of our generation? And Tom Hanks said, it's because he has a fluency in the language of what it takes to elicit an emotional reaction. And that's such an important sentence because photography without emotion is nothing. And people that speak kindly about what I do, they say, well, it just speaks to me. That picture speaks to me a little bit. What they're, I think, getting at is that there is some sort of emotion that is evoked. And before we were shooting The Wolf of Wall Street, my interpretation of it, I must have watched the dealing room scenes about 50, 60 times to understand how tight his composition was. And it was the sequence of events were bizarre because it was key to me. I had to get Jordan Belfort, the real Wolf of Wall Street, involved. So I got to know Jordan a little bit over last year, and he agreed to partake. And when we got the final picture back, I plucked up the courage after a few glasses of wine to send it to Leo DiCaprio. And immediately he shouted back, he said, that's dope. Can I show it to Scorsese? And I said, of course you can. I'd be honored. And they both signed it, which was a lovely moment. And it was quite a thrill that after he's one of my heroes that he signed the picture.
I want to switch tag a little bit because I'm sure many listening will think what an extraordinary and glamorous life as well. But there is, of course, the big downside of the social media environment in which we live. And I'm reminded that I think it was Churchill who said that a lie can travel halfway around the world before the truth has a chance to get his trousers on. And I just wonder how you deal with some of the criticisms that get leveled at you.
You're very right that success, however you define success, is a double-edged sword. My starting premise on photography is that I think it's collegiate. The lead photographers in the world on the fine art side, I think they tend to like each other and respect each other. It's the ones underneath you've got to be a little bit careful of. And if you do anything that gives them an opportunity, you better be prepared. I've made mistakes. There are three antidotes to the haters or the opportunists that want to be seen to have a go. The first one is philanthropy, and we totally embrace philanthropy at a level that I think is unusual in our space. The second one is more important, which is just to get better. As Steve Martin said about LA, he said the trick in LA is be so damn good they can't ignore you. And I'm very, very tough on myself. And you should get better. If you didn't get better, the game's up. You should just be getting better. We've got every opportunity. We've got the muscle, the financial resource, the human intellectual resource. The third antidote is just to make for God sure that you don't give them an opportunity. And that's the one that occasionally we've fallen down on. If you look at the Me Too campaign, which has given rise to, rightly, huge changes in what is perceived to be politically correct and what is perceived to be politically incorrect. When you and I first started in finance, if you opened a door for a woman behind you, that was the chivalrous right thing to do. Now, in some circles, that can be seen to be patronizing or objectifying or not in the spirit of a level playing field, whereas I just consider it to be good manners. 30 years ago, the best-selling fine art photographs were all of, not all, but a large percentage of them were of female form photography. Helmut Newton made a career out of photographing naked women. The shot of the girl face down on a bed in the 8th district in Paris with a shaft of light coming through the window, that was his genre. That was the style that he was known. If you look at the Sotheby's auction last week, their yearly photographic auction, most important one, tough time to have an auction last week, the value has collapsed in terms of gratuitous use of female form. So whenever we photograph women, almost without exception now, they will be fully clothed.
So you touched on philanthropy. I believe I'm right in saying that you've helped donate over $8 million to charitable campaigns. Tell me how you, in a world where there's a lot of need, how have you thought about prioritizing that?
This is why people don't have foundations any longer, because if you are a well-known person in a corporate America or an actor in corporate America, whatever, and you think you want to do good, you set up a foundation. That's what you used to do. But of course, by doing that, you open yourself up. Even if all you're doing is good, no good deed goes unpunished, people then come and hit you with the second derivative and saying, twofold, they say, it's interesting you're giving money to Tanzania, because given the degree of corruption in Tanzania, we've heard that only 4 cents in the dollar actually gets through to your end cause. So those that are trying, some that are trying to do good through setting up their own foundation, they got hit with both these things. Can you legitimize your attribution between children healthcare, the place where you're born, da 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 da? And secondly, what is the efficacy? What is the shrinkage through fraud in terms of the place you're going? And I know of several big hitters that have closed down their foundation because of the era of immediate information, everyone judging everyone else's efforts, even though we're all searching for good cause. And also, I care more about people than I care about animals. So I do a lot of conservation work because it's only right given the enormous privileges I have had. But organizations like Best Buddies in the States, Room to Read, Children's Education, my brother unfortunately suffers from Parkinson's. We all have our stories to tell in healthcare. So children's education is important. I want to have a geographical sensibility to my upbringing as well. And that's why Scotland plays a bit of a bigger role. And then when the Australian fires happened this year, we felt we could be spontaneous and go there straight away. And thanks to collaboration from great people around the world, we raised $1.5 million fairly quickly in Australia. And we will be doing something with the NHS in the next 10 days. I'm working right now in terms of if you're a brand and being seen to want to help, you've got to be bloody careful, because there's already been some kickback of in the media. So we're very conscious of doing it with as much sensibility to the mood of the nation as is necessary now. But I hope that with the help of a lot of people, we can certainly help.
You have been extremely successful. You've been extremely generous, and I think you should be saluted for that. But let's just move to the final section of this conversation. Frank Sinatra did it his way. Would you have done anything differently?
Yes. There's so many mistakes that I've made over the last, throughout my life, really, but that's an integral part of growing up and eventually getting somewhere where you succeed. It's an iterative process. I've maybe not been as good a friend to some people as I could have been because I have not picked up the phone enough to friends. And at times of need, I think I've been selfish.
And we have young listeners who are beginning to embark on their careers. What advice would you give to them?
It's funny, my daughter is just very proud of her. Started at Oxford and she's reading history. In her final term at school, someone came in from the careers college and said, do you know, in 6 years' time, half of you will be in jobs that didn't exist a year ago. And that is how quickly the world is changing, that we are living. When you and I were growing up, if you didn't know what to do, you went to Hong Kong. If you didn't know what to do but wanted to stay in the UK, you joined an estate agent. If you thought you had to get an education, you became an accountant or a lawyer. And if you just wanted the fast bucks, you went into the city. And it was really that simple. Or you could become a priest or go into the army, but we didn't know anything like that. But now there are no obvious career choices. I certainly, when I'm giving advice, there's two or three things. Number one, if it's a hot area, be wary. People that know nothing and throw words around, say, oh, I hear this private equity thing is jolly good. Maybe Johnny should go into private equity. Well, that's a massive area. What exactly do you mean by private equity? It encompasses so many different facets. I do think one message from my side is that I started following my passion when I was 44, 45. These are shocking, horrific times right now for us, for our generation. But we all are, by and large, living longer lives. 44 is quite young in your life. I don't think I'll ever retire. I think people that are seeing what it's like to live at home at the moment, a lot of people are saying, I'm never going to retire. I don't want to be back in this situation again. But you must follow your passion. If you have a passion and you don't follow it, things can fall into place. You can get lucky. A lot of people try that. But if you have a passion and you follow it, you've got a good chance of having a very happy life. And that would be my message.
So my final question is, you're not allowed to take your camera. You're only allowed to go back to one place in the world for 3 days. Where would it be?
I think my favorite place in the world is probably Montana in America. And it's because it's got that combination of majestic scenery that we know from The Horse Whisperer and just that big sky scenery. So many great movies done there. A river runs through it, which was shot there. But then that is complemented by people that they're all something out of some sort of exaggerated novel. The people that live in the mountains up there that I've cast in a lot of my shots are extraordinary characters. It is God's country. And when you arrive, if for people that haven't been there, when you arrive at Bozeman Airport and you see the big sky, it really is a very, very special place with special people.
David, well, what a journey, what an adventure, what success, and how much have I enjoyed listening to you, and I hope our listeners will derive as much pleasure as I had. So I just want to thank you very much indeed for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you for listening to this episode. The Money Maze podcast is free, and if you liked what you heard, please write a review on iTunes or Google Play to help others discover the show. If you'd like to keep up with our work, please search the Money Maze podcast on LinkedIn, at Money Maze Podcast on Facebook, or at Money Maze Podcast on Instagram. Finally, you'll find other information at our website, www.moneymazepodcast.com. Until next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.